that sort of stuck with you because you've been, you've had a very broad view of
So that, I know I felt very much that that was an important influence on me. And so the advanced physics and chemistry I took, I'm sure, was very extremely useful to me. And, I don't remember those people as much. The math teacher was a fascinating character, Arnold Dresden. I wasn't a particularly talented mathematician, although I always was able to get A in all the courses. Except one. I got one B in Swarthmore. It was an exam. I took the exam when I had a 105 degree temperature. I wound up getting a B in that course.
There's always an experience like that.
But I wasn't theoretically enough inclined to be a good mathematician.
But you had enough facility to use it, that's right.
Yeah, but it did give me, I got exposed to enough of it and pushed hard enough in it so that it, so that I wasn't afraid to use it. And I understood the principles, but I wasn't.
That sort of comes out in the papers of yours that I've read, that, you know, you always had sufficient facility to attack the problem. And it didn't seem, that's interesting. I got that impression from reading the papers, too, that you weren't afraid to attack the problem. Mm. And, which is,
that's certainly what you get out of that. Even though you don't feel like you picked up enough facility to be a real mathematician, you at least feel familiar with it enough so you're not scared to death to, to jump in and try it, take a crack at it.
Right.
And you do get a feel for the principles, even though you don't have all the the working activity at your fingertips. And that makes a big difference.
As you were finishing up at Swarthmore, do you have any recollection of what your perceptions of being a chemist were? That is, now you've chosen to be a chemist. What did you think being a chemist meant?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I suppose I was about as naive and unthinking about my future as you could imagine.
Probably no more so than any other person graduating.
When I look back at my own kids, they did a lot more thinking about what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it. I really hadn't faced up to what I was going to do when I got out of college. Jerry Creighton told me I ought to go into graduate school, so I went on to graduate school. Getting my PhD in 21 months at Harvard didn't give me a lot of time to think about what I was going to do when I got through Harvard. I never took an interview for a job. I never won. Not even one interview for a job. Even though I was pretty sure I was going to finish up.
Yeah, right.
I didn't, just didn't bother.
Yeah.
And I did apply for a National Research Council fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
I think either Fieser or Kohler suggested I ought to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied for that to go on to do some more research. And one day Kohler called me up into his office and said he'd had a letter from Roger Adams. Roger was on the committee that chose the National Research Council fellowships. And apparently Roger liked the looks of what they were saying about me and said, and had written to Kohler and said, would I be interested in working with Roger?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was so naive, I didn't even know who Roger Adams was at that point. So Kohler told me.
He's a good friend of Kohler's, apparently.
So Kohler essentially just told me, he said, you go out and work with Adams. So I went out and worked with Adams. That was a great move. I was delighted with it.
Yeah, obviously it was. I want to get back to that because the comparison is very important to me, that what happened between one and the other. But I don't think you need to feel embarrassed about it. I have not yet spoken to anybody who I think made that move at any time with any preconceived notion of what it was like. But I'm waiting for somebody to tell me. That's right. I know what it was like to be a chemist. Did you ever consider being anything but an academic chemist?
As I say, I really didn't think about it.
Yeah.
As far as I can remember, it wasn't one of those conscious things that I said, well, if I do this and do this and do this, I'll become a professor.
Yeah.
I think I could have easily gone into industrial work. I've been very successful as a consultant. I do like to feel that the things I do have some practical importance, and contrast to many of my colleagues in the academic world who think it's what they're doing has some useful application, there's something wrong with it. I've never felt that way. I've always felt, gee, it's just an extra bonus to me if what I'm doing has also got some useful applications and practical use. So I think I could have become a successful industrial chemist. I had quite a few offers to do so, but once I got established in academic work, I liked it so much I never even considered them seriously. But I can't say that I can remember today that I made any kind of conscious thought that, gee, I wanted to become a college professor. I can't, if I ever thought it, I can't remember it. It wasn't one of the conscious things up at the front of my mind.
Yeah.
I just liked what I was doing so much that I guess what I wanted to do was keep on doing it. And I didn't think about how very much. I thoroughly enjoyed chemistry and always have. It's kind of a little wrench a few years ago to give it up for a variety of reasons, but I definitely have. Given up active pursuit of chemistry in favor of some other things, but that was my motivating force, was just to keep on having fun.
Yeah.
And to me, it was just plain fun to do these things. It was exciting fun to solve these problems. Any kind of a problem, I still get a big kick out of it. I hate the guts of these lawyers and what they do to you, but they're tossing problems at you, and solving those problems is still a delightful challenge to me, which I get a lot of satisfaction out of.
What about the courses that you took at Harvard? You must have decided to do research very quickly.
I started research almost a week or two after I got there. Because I didn't have to take any of what were called the first year graduate courses.
Mm-hmm.
With our honors program, they let me skip the first level.
So you didn't take Kohler's course?
I took Kohler's course.
You did?
That course I wouldn't have missed. That was a gem of a course.
Okay, I'm very interested in Kohler because...
He was a great teacher.
Uh-huh.
Great teacher. And I thoroughly enjoyed his course. And I took Kisty's course in thermodynamics. I took a course by Fieser, the course he was given in natural products, you know, which became his book on natural products related to financing. That was the course he gave. I don't think I took a course from Paul Bartlett. I think those are the only three courses I can remember for sure. There might have been a fourth. I think they had a chem engineer from MIT that came up and offered a course that I audited.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I took it for credit. Sort of a graduate level.
I don't know. I had a course offered in sewage disposal or something like that for a number of years. I don't know.
No, this was chemical processes or something. You know, he talked about how you do chemical processing.
Okay.
I can't remember for sure, but I took a course. I'm sure I took a course from Louis Fieser. I know I took Kohler's course, and I know I took Kisty's course.
Do you remember the orientation of Kohler's course at that time? The kinds of things he did.
He talked about a lot about. Well, I guess you'd call it, for that day, not really mechanisms, but he talked a lot about how to do chemical reactions. And he picked examples from the literature and gave us the stuff, the details of how different kinds of reactions, like the addition to alpha, beta, carbon, double bonds, the ketones, I can remember a lot of stuff he gave.
Yeah.
That was, of course, one of his research interests.
Yes, right.
Very close. He did a lot of work on the Michael reaction. he gave us a lot of the detail, you know, which reactions work and how, and what changes in the structure cause it to go 1-2 rather than 1-4. And not mechanisms in what's come to be the sense we see it now, but
yes,
very much how does structure affect the reactivity of organic compounds.
Okay, that's
in a little more classical. I mean, the factors that make green yards add 1-2 versus 1-4, that kind of thing. We get a lot of discussion.
I know it was raising problems for you.
I can still remember in my notes from his course and Fieser's course. I guess there wasn't a lecture that I went to that I didn't write down in my notes a couple of research problems I thought would be interesting to undertake as a result of what the kind of way they were teaching, you know, it stimulated you. They raised the questions, you know, here's what we know, here are a lot of things we don't know. And I kept writing down, my notes had all kinds of ideas so they certainly did give lectures that stimulated that kind of thinking on my part, because I can remember distinctly, you know, I'd kind of sidelight something that looked to me like that they hadn't talked about, but seemed to me to be an interesting research problem.
The problem, your first problem, you've already said that, you know, it seemed to me very, very physically oriented for Fieser, and obviously you waited for the right problem to come along. And what was his feeling about the way the problem then proceeded? Obviously you were doing a very physical analysis of the problem as well. Was he concerned what was his feeling about that?
I have to give Fieser credit. You know, the problem wound up measuring rates of reaction and equilibrium. The bromine addition was an equilibrium reaction, and we could measure the equilibrium constant. Now, Fieser had gotten his PhD thesis on equilibrium constants, the oxidation reduction potentials of quinones is a thermodynamic study. And he still did a lot of work in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was an area which Fieser knew a lot about. So Fieser was more of a physical, had a better grasp than most people give him credit for, because he liked the synthetic, and he did an awful lot of good synthetic chemistry. Yeah. But he also did a hell of a lot of work on synthesizing quinones, all kinds of quinones, with all kinds of substituents, and measuring the effect of substituents on them, on the oxidation reduction potentials of quinones. So I think Louis, I don't want to give the impression that Louis was not interested and not able to do this, but at the same time, it was very helpful to have Paul Bartlett in the lab right next door so I could talk to Paul very easily about
his own research had been right on along those lines, and so and of course he was doing that.
And when Louis presented the problem to me, of course at that time there was a theory that had been advanced in the older German literature that substitution of benzene went through an addition reaction.
Yes.
And here's an example where you could isolate the addition intermediate and convert it to the substitution product. And Louis just thought, well, we ought to see if we could prove that that was in fact the way it went. And what we proved was that that was not the way it went, although we didn't establish whether it was a free radical or an ion at that time, and nothing I did could establish whether the thing with one bromine added to it was an ion or a radical. I left that very uncommittal in my thesis and in my papers I published.
Yeah, I remember there was a hint of a radical mechanism at that time.
Well, I'm sure that we knew that light did catalyze the reaction, and I guess there's no question in my mind now that the addition reaction could go by it. Was photocatalytic and could go that way, but so we just didn't have enough evidence to be sure that it went through the electrophilic attack, which of course is where it does go. That was just a little before the best evidence for that came along.
Yeah, you spent quite a bit of time afterwards working on electrophilic substitution. So that was not the last of that. We were talking to Fieser and to Bartlett and to Tarbell. Who else around were you talking to? I don't know if you had time to talk to anybody.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed Kisty's course in thermo, and I think that was a very, very useful course.
Mm-hmm.
I did well in it. I liked it, which was not more than most of the organic chemists. They hated the thermo. At least the typical organic doesn't like that kind of stuff. And I did pretty well with Kisty. And I enjoyed it, and found he was an interesting teacher, and I learned a lot more thermodynamics. I had a fair background in thermo from college, but that course was a very useful one.
Do you remember who books from that time or people that you were reading, papers that you were reading that you felt were particularly important?
You know, one of the reasons, not by any means the most important, that I decided to retire early was that I was losing my mind. I had a terrible time remembering details of the people and names. Let me think about that. That's a good question. Books did I find particularly? I certainly thought Conant's book in organic chemistry was a gem for that time.
Mm-hmm.
He had a different approach to it. Organic chemistry, and his textbook was a very good, I thought was a very good book. What others? God, I must have read a lot of them.
Did you know anything about the German literature? Huckel, for example, or was that anything that was required at that time?
Yes, I'm sure we got exposed a little bit to Huckel.
The organic chemist, not the
Well, I just don't know. See, I finished in 30. I really finished my courses in 35.
Mm-hmm.
My last year was entirely research. When was Huckel's work coming in?
He had a book out in about 1930. Or 31.
Yeah,
this is the organic chemist, which then I think there were a couple of volumes, and it was foundations of organic chemistry, that kind of thing. And I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out whether that had much of an impact in the U.S. People seem to know about it, but I'm not sure that it had that.
Well, I guess. You're well aware of the fact that I was never one of the ardent, overzealous supporters of the resonance theory.
That's interesting that you should say that, because you know that there were some things that came out of the papers that suddenly
I fought those guys very vigorously, and Saul Winstein had a public burning of my book on carbon-carbon double bonds because I didn't genuflex enough to
see
the resonance theory.
Because I know in the in that review article, it was a 1941 review article, you spent a lot of time trying to do mainly inductive effects. I mean, you weren't calling them inductive effects. And well, then
direct electrostatic
yeah,
effects.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're damned important.
Yes.
And the resonance theory tried to give all kinds of hocus-pocus explanations for simple electrostatics. That's
mm-hmm.
ridiculous. There are effects that are genuine, that are resonance.
Yes.
An allyl radical is stabilized by resonance, and I'm perfectly willing to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
But a cation is stabilized a hell of a lot more by electrostatic effects than it is by resonance effects most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, because I was willing to say that there were electrostatic effects and that everything wasn't due to resonance, the resonance zealots, and I think they were zealots,
right.
Castigated me for that. I've often wondered, well, that's why I never got in the National Academy, because too many of them were in there.
I see.
I don't know. You know, that's something you just never know.
Yeah.
But
But a lot of those people were very, very vigorously opposed to my ideas about the importance of simple little plus and minus effects, which, you know, are fundamental physics, and they got to be an extremely important part of chemistry.
I know, even, I think the last paper you suggest I read since I gave you a cutoff date was, I think, the 51 paper, which is a reevaluation of the electrostatic effects, and again, you were very strong on those.
Louis Hammond, I think, reviewed that paper and just castigated it. He said it was, you know, this is the kind of stuff that a poor senior might do, or something like that. Oh, it was a blistering statement. I'm not sure it was Hammond, but I just have a suspicion.
It's funny, because I've been talking to Hammond quite a bit recently. He lives just 20 miles from here, and he seems like such a nice gentleman, except I have a number of rumors here and there that he could be very harsh when it came to it. So,
well, I have great admiration for him, but I'm not at all sure it was reciprocal.
Do you remember any of the other graduate students?
Sure.
I know.
Yes. I think, Stan Darbell, I remember very well. He's always been a good friend. He comes to visit me occasionally when he comes to Philadelphia.
Dan was here recently, and I got to interview him.
Yeah, he gets here frequently because he's interested in history and chemistry.
That's right. He also has a sister who lives nearby.
Charlie Bradshaw was a lab mate, and I see a fair amount of Charlie Bradshaw, who's now a professor at Duke. Another lab mate was Elmar Martin, who was worked all his life at DuPont. A third very interesting guy was Arnold Seligman, was in our lab, the guy that synthesized methylcalanthrene for Louis Fieser, later became an MD, died recently of cancer, spent most of his career working on cancer research, and then died of cancer recently. Let's see who some of the other people I remember up there. Warren Lothrop, who worked for what was the company that on Route 128, Boston consulting company, Arthur D. Little. Those were we had five of us in a lab together. Those were the five lab mates that I got particularly well acquainted with. Max Tischler was up there. I got acquainted with Max Tischler in those days. Mel Newman I still see a lot of. Mel was a postdoc with Louis Fieser, working in the basement in a different lab. Mel was here just a few weeks ago to do a lecture at Bryn Mawr to play some golf with me. Hirschberg was a chemist that worked with Louis then down in the basement, but Mel was the postdoc that I got best acquainted with. Mm-hmm. Hirschberg was helpful to me in some of my synthetic problems. Mm-hmm. He went on to work with one of the drug companies, I can't remember which one. Max worked for Kohler. I got acquainted with them. I did talk a modest amount to some of the analytical chemists. I've always had close contact with analytical chemists, because whenever you're going to measure the rate of a reaction, your number one problem is an analytical problem.
Right.
And I got acquainted with Baxter, old G.P. Baxter. Mm-hmm. And there was another guy up there that I talked a fair amount to, an organic analytical chemist. Forbes. Had done photochemistry, and since we were measuring these reactions in photometer, they were exposed to light, and so I had to get interested in photochemistry.
I remember there was a comment in one of the papers about how in certain reactions you let the light run all the time, and then others you started switching it on. Yeah. That was interesting. Yeah.
So I remember Forbes. He was an interesting character. That's about the deepest I can fish out of the people I remember up there.
general impressions about, I don't know, just the overall climate, if you want, compare it to what Illinois was like when you you left and went to Illinois. What were the differences, or can you express what you thought Harvard was like at that time?
Well, they both had one thing in common, that they had a work ethic. I mean, you worked hard and you enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
The personal climate was totally different.
Yeah.
I can illustrate that by a little anecdote. When I got out to Illinois, I started playing squash with a geologist out there. And we got to be very good friends. He's an excellent squash player, one of the few that could pin my ears back. And so we had a lot of fun together playing squash. The hell of a Sharp, that's his name. He's become a very nationally well-known geologist. And a few, you know, after several games of squash, we got talking about where we'd gone to graduate school. Well, both going to Harvard graduate school. Well, that's interesting. When were you there? Well, 34 to 36. We were both there. Where did you live? Conan Hall. What floor? Fourth floor. We lived 2 years together on the fourth floor of Conan Hall, and we never even knew we'd seen each other before when we met a few years later. That's typical, the atmosphere at Harvard. I mean, it's a very aloof, unfriendly atmosphere. And you get out in the Midwest, you know, everybody, the milkman, everybody says hello to you, you know. It's just, you just have a totally different atmosphere of that kind. When Fieser came around to talk to me, it was always business. What's new? Roger Adams, as I worked as a postdoc for, he'd come around and he'd spend an hour talking about his latest trip to China, or, you know. It's just a very much more relaxed, friendly atmosphere.
I'm pleased to hear you say this.
Science-wise, Harvard was super. I mean, I don't know. Hey, there must have been other good places to go too, but I just can't imagine that there are any places I could have done better than I did at Harvard. Very few that would have let you get through in 21 months.
Right.
They had strict rules about 3 years and this sort of thing.
Yep.
Harvard didn't have strict rules. They didn't have to have strict rules. So I was always extremely pleased with my experience at Harvard. And not only just in science. I did a few more things up there. I played 2 years of lacrosse with the Boston Lacrosse Club. Some of my best lacrosse I ever played was with the best in Boston Lacrosse Club. And I coached the JV Harvard lacrosse team.
Goodness.
And I got started on my interest in classical music. I had no interest in classical music. This is another thing, Stan Tarbell. They had that old Mem Hall up there, you know.
Yeah, right.
The Boston Symphony used to give us about once a month, they'd come out and give us a concert out there.
Uh-huh.
And Stan used to go, and there was a little peanut gallery up over the stage that you could get in for a dollar. And one night I didn't really want to work, and Stan was going over there. He says, "Why don't you come over?" And he says, "Only cost you a dollar." So I said, "Well, I couldn't. Guess it wouldn't be too bad to waste a dollar." Well, I don't think I missed another concert after that. I regularly went to them. So Harvard had a lot of other assets that have influenced me. I've ever since been very much interested in symphonic music. I'm no performer. I don't perform anything, but I sure enjoy listening to it.
Well, when you left Harvard, what kind of a chemist did you consider yourself?
Organic chemist.
You were an organic chemist.
With a strong interest in physical organic mechanisms, but physical organic was hardly born at that
yes,
time.
Yes, that's right. That's.
But I was interested in mechanisms of reactions, and I did not get much sympathy for that at Illinois.
That was my next question.
I had to fight for that at Illinois, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
They were all classical organic chemists out there, and they were not at all sure that this new way of looking at mechanisms was all that great. Mm-hmm. I got along fine with it, but you know, I definitely had to earn my way out there on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. How were you supported in Illinois?
Roger Adams had his own money for postdocs, I suppose, from the university.
Yeah, he did have money that he had managed to pick up. Every time he'd get an offer from another university, he'd pick up another postdoc.
I've used the same gimmick.
And you were, you were listed as a research assistant, but that you were a postdoc.
That's a postdoc. Yeah. I was called a research assistant to Roger Adams. I guess I was paid by University of Illinois.
Okay. Do you have any idea how much you were paid at that time?
$1,800.
Okay.